Hello, hello, hello. You just heard Just Friends by Oscar Peterson and Ralph Moore. Before that, you heard Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea by George Harrison. And before that, Junk by Paul McCartney. I'm DJ Wingspan, and thank you so much for listening.
Okay, good afternoon. This is KDVS 90.3. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am DJ Safikar. We are broadcasting not far from where the village of Putatoy once stood, inhabited by Patwin Native Americans. This is the third week we're looking at The Burnout Society by Byung-Chul Han, which was first published in 2010. In the first chapter, Han argues that when we look at the landscape of pathology of the beginning of the 21st century, what we find is psychological problems such as depression, loneliness, exhaustion, and mainly burnout syndrome. Han explains our current predicament and the norms that govern our societies in 21st century by contrasting them with the values of previous century, which he coins the immunological age. Han explains the immunological epoch sought to distinguish clearly between inside and outside, friend and foe, self and the other. According to Han, our age is marked by the disappearance of otherness and foreignness. Otherness is being replaced with difference, which in terms of immunology represents the same. In the second chapter called Beyond Disciplinary Society, Han contrasts the achievement society with the disciplinary society. Han argues that today's society is no longer Foucault's disciplinary world of hospitals, madhouses, prisons, barracks, and factories. It has long since been replaced by another regime, namely a society of fitness studios, office towers, banks, airports, shopping malls, and genetic laboratories. 21st century society is no longer a disciplinary society, but rather an achievement society. Also, its inhabitants are no longer obedient subjects, but achievement subjects. They are entrepreneurs of themselves. Capitalism is about productivity, and disciplinary technology has its limits. To heighten productivity, the negativity of prohibition is replaced with the positive scheme of can. Achievement subjects are much more productive. In this way, the achievement subjects exploit itself, and it does so voluntarily, without external constraint. It is a predator and a prey at once. Han thinks self-exploitation is simply the latest stage of capitalism. Rather than being pressured to maximize our individual productivity by external forces, we now willingly exploit ourselves in the name of individual achievement and bettering ourselves. The other characteristic of achievement society, according to Han, is hyperattention. Excessive positivity expresses itself as an excess of stimuli, information, and impulses. It radically changes the structure and economy of attention. Perception becomes fragmented and scattered. Han maintains that attitude toward time and environment, known as multitasking, does not represent civilizational progress. Rather, such an aptitude amounts to regression. We owe the cultural achievement of humanity, which includes philosophy, to deep contemplative attention. Culture presumes an environment in which deep attention is possible. Increasingly, such immersive reflection is being displaced by an entirely different form of attention, hyperattention, a rash change of focus between different tasks, sources of information, and processes categorizes this scattered mode of awareness. Since it also has a low tolerance of boredom, it does not admit the profound idleness that benefits the creative process. Whatever is floating, inconspicuous, or fleeting reveals itself only to the deep contemplative attention. Likewise, it's only contemplative lingering that has access to phenomena that are long and slow. In chapter 4, Hahn turns to The Human Condition by Hannah Arendt, first published in 1958. In this work, Arendt seeks to rehabilitate the concept of life of action against the primacy of a long tradition that has granted a life of mind a special place and to articulate its inner richness in a new way. In her estimation, the traditional view has wrongly reduced vita activa to mere restlessness. Arendt connects her evaluation of vita activa, the life of action, to the priority of action. Hahn notes that for Arendt, modern society as a society of laboring nullifies any possibility for action when it degrades the human being into animal laboring, a beast of burden. Action, she maintains, occasions new possibilities, yet modern humanity passively stands at the mercy of anonymous process of living. As Arendt sees it, modernity begins with an unprecedented heroic activation of human capacity, yet it ends in mortal passivity. All forms of vita activa, both the matter of producing and that of acting, sink to the level of simple laboring. Arendt maintains that the life of modern individual is submerged in the overall life process of the species. Under these circumstances, the only active decision would be to let go, so to speak, to abandon individuality and to acquiesce to a functional type of behavior. Hahn complains that Arendt's description of the modern animal laborants do not correspond to what we can observe in today's achievement society. The late modern animal laborants does not give up its individuality or ego in order to emerge. Through the work it performs with the anonymous life processes of the species. Rather, the contemporary labor society as a society of achievement and business fosters individuality. All right, in chapter 5, called A Pedagogy of Seeing, the life of the mind presupposes instruction in a particular way of seeing. In The Twilight of the Idols, Nietzsche claims that learning to see means getting your eyes used to calm, to patience, to letting things come to you. That is, making yourself capable of deep and contemplative attention, casting a long and slow gaze. Such learning to see represents the first preliminary schooling for spirituality. One must learn not to react immediately to a stimulus, but instead to take control of the inhibiting, excluding instincts. By the same token, every characteristic absence of spirituality, every piece of common vulgarity is due to an inability to resist a stimulus, the inability to say no in opposition. Reacting immediately, yielding to every impulse, already amounts to illness and represents a symptom of exhaustion. For Nietzsche, the vita contemplativa is not a matter of passive affirmation of being open to whatever happens. Instead, it offers resistance to crowding, intrusive stimuli. Hahn notes that as a mode of saying no, sovereign action proves more active than any and all hyperactivity, which represents a symptom of mental exhaustion. Hahn contends that only by the negative means of making pause can the subject of action thoroughly measure the sphere of contingency. Although delaying does not represent a positive deed, it proves necessary if action is not to sink to the level of laboring. All right, all of that was a summary of what has gone on in the past couple of shows. Now we're going to deal with chapter 6 and 7. Chapter 6 is called Bartleby Case. Bartleby the Scrivener is a short story by Herman Melville, first published in 1853. It is subtitled A Story of Wall Street. It is a tragicomedy. It is certainly a little disturbing, and it's quite strange. It's also slightly fantastic. I'll go over the story before we look at what Hahn has to say about it. In this story, we have a protagonist who acts and conducts himself in a very unconventional manner, and we're not told why. This makes for a puzzle. which the reader is invited to find some answers to on their own and to speculate about. The narrator is a Wall Street attorney. He has an office and two employees. They are scriveners or copyists. They copy legal documents by hand. The lawyer decides to hire another copyist. He hires Bartleby. He does this in part because Bartleby is very calm and mild-mannered. And the lawyer is hoping that Bartleby may influence the other copyist, who can be obnoxious. At the beginning, Bartleby is a good employee and does his job well. But after a few days, he gradually stops doing any work at all. And anytime someone asks him to do a task, he responds by saying, "I would prefer not to." The narrator is tempted to fire him on the spot, but he's moved by how calm and in control Bartleby is. So he decides against letting him go. Commentary: this brother is acting up and at the same time not acting up. And he's not acting crazy. One would think if he was rude and aggressive, the lawyer would know exactly how to deal with him. But because he's unruffled, this is strange. Next day, he's asked to do something. Bartleby again responds the same way with, "I would prefer not to." When he's asked for an explanation, he doesn't give one. The lawyer has to stop by the office on Sunday, and he's surprised to find Bartleby is now living there. He again asks for an explanation and implores Bartleby to be reasonable, but he would prefer not to. Bartleby is beginning to have bad influence on his co-workers, so he finally is fired, but he refuses to leave. Bartleby is in the office the next day and hanging around, not actively disturbing anyone. In order to get rid of him, the lawyer decides to move his office to a new location. But people from his former office show up and demand that Bartleby be removed from the premises. So the narrator goes back to his old office and tries to reason with Bartleby. He even offers Bartleby to come and live with him for a while and promises to help him to find a job. But Bartleby declines, and the narrator becomes frustrated and he leaves. The lawyer goes away for a few days. When he comes back, he discovers that his old landlord has had Bartleby arrested and put in prison. The narrator goes to visit him there. Bartleby refuses help, and he's also not eating. The lawyer finds a man who works in the kitchen and pays him some money to look after Bartleby. But the next day, he comes for a visit and he finds that Bartleby has died of starvation. The lawyer recalls that before working for him, Bartleby had worked in a debt letter office. So, what is a debt letter office? Let's see. A debt letter or an undeliverable letter is a mail that cannot be delivered because it has an incomplete address and return address. Many countries process this sort of mail in what is called debt letter office. Postal workers in this office can open the letter and look for clues as to where exactly it's coming from or where is the destination. If there is none, they keep anything of value and then destroy the letter. The lawyer's theory seems to be that reading all these debt letters intended for people who would never get them must have been so depressing that it slowly drove Bartleby to his apathetic and emotionally detached state. Here's Hahn's treatment of Bartleby. Hahn claims Melville's Bartleby, which has often been the object of metaphysics and theological interpretation, also admits a pathological reading. This is a little odd because most interpretation of this story are socio-political, and reviews often read this work as being critical of capitalism. The repeated emphasis on the monotony of office work appears to support this. Melville appears to be suggesting that the world of finance, law, and business stifles and restricts the individual, turning everyone into mindless cogs in the machine of industry. In this context, Bartleby stands out to the narrator because he pushes back against this urge to conform and comply. The job, copying legal documents, pays his wages, but he has few rewards for his spirit. It is routine, repetitive, and challenging. Hahn presents the setting pretty well. He writes, "The story of Wall Street describes an inhumane working world whose inhabitants have all degraded to the state of mindless workers. The sinister atmosphere of the office, choked by skyscrapers on every side, is hostile to life and portrayed in detail. Melancholy and gloominess are often mentioned, and they set the basic mood for the narrative." Okay, so far so good. He then adds, "The attorney's assistant all suffer from neurotic disorder. In their neurotic hyperactivity, these figures represent the opposite of Bartleby, who falls into silent immobility." So we may ask, what is happening to Bartleby? Hahn argues that Bartleby develops the symptom characteristics of neurasthenia, which is nervous exhaustion or nervous breakdown, characterized by chronic fatigue, i.e. burnout syndrome. For Hahn, Bartleby's story, The Wall Street Tale, is a story of exhaustion. In this light, his signature phrase, "I would prefer not to," expresses neither the negative potency of not to nor the instinct for delay and deferral that is essential for spirituality. Rather, it stands for lack of drive and for apathy, which seals Bartleby's doom. Hahn maintains that the society that Melville describes is still a disciplinary society. Walls and partitions, the elements of disciplinary architecture, traverse the entire narrative. Wall is one of the most frequent used words in this story. Whether at work or in prison, Bartleby was often just staring at a wall. Hahn argues Bartleby does not develop symptom of depression, which is a hallmark of late modern achievement society. Feeling of inadequacy, inferiority, or fear of failure do not belong to Bartleby's emotional household. Constant self-reproach, self-aggression are unknown to him. He does not face the imperative to be himself that characterizes late modern achievement society. Bartleby does not fail in the project of being an I. Monotonous copying, the sole activity he has to perform, leaves no free space in which private initiative would prove necessary or even possible. He's not burdened by the late modern imperative of letting his self flourish. The activity of copying, in particular, does not admit initiative. Bartleby, who still lives in a society of convention and institution, does not know the wearing out of the ego that leads to depressive eye tiredness. Hahn notes that the exclamation that ends the tale is both a lament and an indictment. It is, "Oh, Bartleby, oh, humanity." The chapter 7 is called Society of Tiredness. Hahn argues here that one of the characteristics of the achievement society is excessive tiredness and exhaustion. This is one of the symptoms of burnout syndrome. In the beginning of the chapter is very strong and good, so I will read some of that for you. Hahn writes, as a society of activeness, the achievement society is slowly developing into a doping society. In meanwhile, the negative expression brain doping has been replaced by neuroenhancement. Now even serious scientists claim that it's irresponsible not to employ substances of this kind. A surgeon able to operate with a greater concentration by using neuroenhancers would make fewer mistakes and be able to save more lives. Nor is the general use of neuroenhancers viewed as a problem. One need only ensure fairness, namely by putting them at the disposal of all. If doping were still permitted in sports, it would degrade into a pharmaceutical race. For all that, simple prohibitions cannot prevent both the body and the human being as a whole from becoming a performance machine that is supposed to function without disturbance and maximize achievement. Hahn claims that as its flip side, the society achievement and activeness is generating excessive tiredness and exhaustion. Moreover, Hahn maintains that tiredness in achievement society is solitary tiredness. It has a separating and isolating effect. The rest of the chapter is a discussion of two types of tiredness. It's very interesting, but to be honest, I'm not sure that I completely understand it very well. Peter Hanke, in Essay on Tiredness, calls it decisive tiredness. This decisive tiredness strikes one mute and blind. Hanke sets eloquent, seeing, and reconciliatory tiredness in opposition to speechless, sightless, and divisive tiredness. Reconciliatory tiredness opens a between by loosening the strictures of the ego. I'll read that again. Reconciliatory tiredness opens a between by loosening the structures of the ego. I do not just see the other, rather, I also am the other, and the other becomes I too. The between is a space of friendliness as indifference, where no one and nothing dominates or commands. As the I grows smaller, the gravity of being shifts from the ego to the world. It is tiredness that trusts in the world, whereas I tiredness, solitary tiredness, is worldless, world-destroying tiredness. The trusting tiredness opens the I and makes room for the world. It reestablishes the duality that solitary tiredness destroys utterly. One sees and one is seen. One touches and one is touched. Tiredness as a becoming accessible, as the possibility of being touched and of being able to touch in turn, it makes lingering abidance possible in the first place, abidance. Possible. Less I means more world. Such fundamental tiredness brings together all the forms of existence and coexistence that vanish in the course of absolutized activity. Moreover, it hardly amounts to a state of exhaustion in which one proves unable to do anything. Instead, it represents a singular capacity. Fundamental tiredness inspires. It allows spirit-intellect to merge. Thereby, the inspiration of tiredness involves not doing. Tiredness enables the human being to experience singular calm, serene, not doing. It is not a state in which the senses languish or grow dull. Rather, it roses a special kind of visibility. For Hanke, deep tiredness rises to become a form of salvation, a form of rejuvenation. It brings back a sense of wonder into the world. Tiredness makes you younger than you have been. Everything becomes extraordinary in the tranquility of tiredness. Deep tiredness loosens the strictures of identity. Things flicker, twinkle, and vibrate at the edges. They grow less determinate and more porous and lose some of their resolution. This particular indifference lends them an aura of friendliness. Rigid delimitation with respect to one's surrounding is suspended. In such fundamental tiredness, the thing is never manifested alone, but always in conjunction with other things. And even if there are not very many, they will all be together in the end. This tiredness founds a deep friendship and makes it possible to conceive of a community that requires neither belonging nor relation. Hanke's tiredness is not our tiredness. It is not the tiredness of an exhausted ego. He calls it we tiredness. I am not tired of you, as he puts it, but rather I am tired with you. The tiredness of exhaustion is the tiredness of positive potency. It makes one incapable of doing something. Tiredness that inspires is tiredness of negative potency, namely of not to. Tiredness is disarming. In the long, slow gaze of a tired person, resolution yields to a state of calm. The internal, in-between time is a period of indifference as friendliness. Hahn writes, I have been speaking here of tiredness in peacetime. In the present interim period, in those hours, there was peace. And the astonishing part of it was that my tiredness seems to participate in this momentary peace, for my gaze disarmed every intimidation of violent gesture, a conflict, and even an unfriendly attitude before it could get started. Hanke conceives of an immanent religion of tiredness. Fundamental tiredness suspends egological isolation and founds a community that needs no kinship. Here a particular rhythm emerges that leads to agreement, proximity, and vicinity without familial and functional connections. A certain tired man can be seen as a new Orpheus. The wildest beasts gathered around him are at least able to join in his tiredness. Tiredness gives dispersed individual the keynote. All right. I think that's it for this week. So we're going to try to finish this work next week. But now I'm going to try to see if I can find a song for you. It will take a moment. Let's see. Kim. Okay, let's see. Right. Okay. I think we're ready now. Thank you.
getting my headphones on and everything, because I am about to play the Smiles show for y'all. Let me turn that down a little bit. All right. You're listening to KDVS Davis at 90.3 FM, coming up from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m., a.k.a. now, is going to be this week's episode of The Smile Show. Coming up first, a couple messages, and then we're going to get straight into the episode, okay?
Scared. It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Attention KDVS listeners, how is radio reception of our signal in your area? Drop us a line and let us know. Davis, Sacramento, Roseville, even Fairfield, we'd like to better understand our coverage of the Sacramento Valley. Email your location and reception strength to our general manager at gm@kdvs.org to help us get started. Your support is greatly appreciated.
If it were easy, everyone would do it. It takes a special person to join the National MS Society's Bike Tours to Fight MS. If you like a challenge and want to have some fun for a good cause, call 1-800-FIGHT-MS.
Hello. You are listening to KDVS Davis. Coming up right now is The Smile Show. Real quick disclaimer, which is why I'm hopping back on, is that the following views presented in this hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. But without further ado, here is the Smile Show episode for this week.
Community. Well-being, empowerment. Welcome to this week's edition of the Smiles Show and Podcast Smiles. Join our host, Jimmy Smiles, as we connect virtually. And now, here's Jimmy.
And here I am, already back in the saddle or behind the chair, or I guess I'm in the chair, not behind the chair, behind the microphone, in front of the microphone. Anyway, I'm somewhere here in this studio here, the Smile Studio. I'm your host, Jimmy Smiles, and welcome to this week's edition of The Smile Show, which is a weekly public affairs program. And many of you check out the show on Friday afternoons at 5 p.m. Pacific time on 90.3 FM, KDVS in Davis. So let's start with a big round of applause for all of our KDVS